Welcome to the OA Virtual Kitchen Sink Meeting Podcast. Visit the Los Angeles Intergroup at oalaig.org for information on how to join our meeting live and how to donate to support this meeting and our podcasts. The opinions expressed on the Kitchen Sink Podcast are those of the individual speakers and do not represent OA as a whole. And now, our speaker.
My name's Patrick, and I am a compulsive overeater. And I first want to thank Steve for the invitation to your meeting here this morning. I'm always grateful to share my experience, strength, and hope in this sacred fellowship. And the reason I use the word sacred is because I believe what we do here is sacred. It is life-saving, life-redeeming. I'm not a guy that's got power over food. I don't get to make food decisions in my life. And because I doubted that 5 years into OA, I decided to make another run at it while I was having pieces of my body amputated due to the consequences I've suffered from this disease. I'll get into that a little bit when I share my story, but my abstinence date, my back-to-back black and white abstinence date is August 26th of 2020, but I've been in Overeaters Anonymous since the summer of 2015. And if not for a responsible, recovered member of this fellowship who had the courage to confront me at the International AA Convention, because I'm a member of the Grandfather Fellowship, and 12-stepped me into this, you'd have somebody else in the box today. I don't have the you're going to be okay version of this disease. I have the you're going to eat until you die version. I was well over 400. I'm 6 feet tall. I was well over 420 pounds. That was my last known weight. I was dying of type 2 diabetes. I had put on 170 pounds after a triple bypass. And if you ask me how I was doing in those years, 11 years into another 12-step fellowship, I would have told you I was fine. Because I had developed a well-honed recovery ego. I had memorized the first 164 pages of the Big Book as much as anybody can. And I could spout that stuff on a regular basis and sound real good in a meeting. But I didn't live it. And the result was that after a life-threatening experience with beverage alcohol, I had a life-threatening experience with food. And food has always been a part of my story. I'm a kid when I was a little kid, they would find me on the kitchen floor smeared in chocolate after I'd built this tower I'd put a chair by the cupboard. And then I'd put a box on top of it, and then I'd put a big soup pot on top of that, and I'd climb up to that, and I'd get way up in the top cupboard and get that 2-pound bag of chocolate chips and eat the whole thing. I'd sit on the kitchen floor and eat it. And then I'd pass out, 4 years old, 5 years old. And they'd find me, and I did this more than once. They'd find me, and they just assigned it to the fact that I was a mischievous kid. But I'll report to you that I was experiencing the allergy that's described in the doctor's opinion from Jump Street. 5, 6, 7 years old, 8 years old, I'd constantly be chastised for just staring into the beautiful abyss of an open refrigerator, grabbing whatever I could to eat, right? And I didn't know it then, and I didn't know it for a long time, that what I was trying to do was treat an internal condition with something that would give me temporary relief. It's described as the spiritual malady in our 12-step fellowships. And there's a great description of it on page 52 of the Big Book in the middle paragraph where it talks about the bedevilments. That's the best version of the spiritual malady that I've seen. But that's what I was experiencing. I never felt like I belonged in my skin for some reason. And food would change that. And, you know, I put on weight as a kid. I mean, I remember being a little bit embarrassed when my mother would bring me to buy school clothes. We'd have to go into the Husky session. section, right? I was that kid. I wasn't really morbidly obese when I was a kid, but I never remember not being overweight. And I was probably 40 to 50 pounds overweight as an adolescent, and that's when I discovered beverage alcohol and other substances. And I have the allergy to alcohol in a pretty vicious way. I picked up a drink when I was 13 years old, and I went right off the cliff. And this started a 30-year binge drink, binge eat, binge drink, binge eat, binge drink, binge eat cycle. I would wake up hungover from alcohol, and I would eat. And what it was really rooted in, both neither alcohol or food is my problem. My problem is this internal dialogue that I have. I wish, I wish food or alcohol was my problem. I would have stopped, and somebody else would be given a talk this morning. But I don't have the power to do that. And I had to get clear on that. And the scary part about getting clear on that, see, step one is a, I had some pretty educated people in my life about this disease ask me if it was possible I was in more trouble than I thought I was. And I put that out there every time I do a talk, is it possible you're in more trouble than you think you are with this illness? And is it possible that's what's stopping you from recovering from this illness is an opinion about an experience you haven't had yet? Because the 12 steps is what saved my life, a relationship with a God of my understanding that I found as a result of working those steps, and then sharing that message with others who suffer. That's why I'm still abstinent. That's why I haven't found it necessary to consume beverage alcohol for 20 years. And I know I'm talking about another fellowship in this meeting, and I want to respect the traditions of OA, but my story is intrinsically linked to that. And here's why. I would have told you at 11 years sober, when I was sitting at the International AA convention at 420 pounds, suffering from type 2 diabetes, my legs were numb from the knees down. I couldn't feel my feet. I could walk about 700 to 1,000 feet at a time. If you ask me that day how I am, I'll tell you I'm recovered. And I'm anything but. What I've done is develop a recovery ego. I've learned lingo. I've learned how to show up. I've learned how to sound good. But I can't practice these principles in a third of my affairs, let alone all of them. I will give voice to doing inventory, but I won't write. My prayer and meditation practice is as I get in my car to back up to go to work when I can make it, and I say, "Hey, boss, help me out here." And 2 minutes later, I'm driving out of my driveway, flipping somebody the bird because I'm road raging. I'm not a demonstration of these principles in all my affairs. The big book asks us to be a demonstration of these principles in our homes, occupations, and affairs. And I'm not going to sit here and tell you that a lot of good didn't happen to me as a result of being in the other fellowship. It did. Saved my life. Saved my life. And by the way, I was able to carry the message to a number of men who will report to you, who are still in my life, who will report to you that my ability to communicate recovery was good, and that they took the actions necessary to find a relationship with a power greater than themselves, and much good was done. My life was better. But this insidious dialogue internally that I should be comfortable. My first year in Overeaters Anonymous, my sponsor asked me a question one day that, honestly, I found offensive because, see, I have one speed when I come in here. I have one feeling, offended. First of all, I'm offended that I'm here, that I have to be here. The second thing is I'm offended by the pathway to recovery because I have an opinion about an experience I haven't had yet. I'll tell you that it won't work for me having not tried it. It's ridiculous. My ego is driving the bus in every area of my life. I'm dying, and I can't get to that place to be honest with. The fact is I just don't know why I do what I do with food. And I don't know how to not do what I do with food, because I've always done what I do with food to feel okay. And you're not going to take it away from me, because when you do, when you take food away from me, when you take the substance that I use to feel comfortable away from me, the way I experience my day-to-day life is really bad. I suffer from the spiritual malady. You know, on page 52, it describes it so well. I like to talk about it because I didn't know what I was up against. And if not for a responsible recovered member of this fellowship who asked me, you know, is it possible that you missed something in We Agnostics, right? Because you claim to believe in a power greater than yourself, but you won't let that, you know, I was on a meeting earlier this morning with, I don't know, another OA meeting that happens from the East Coast. That's where it originates on Zoom. There's 350 people from all over the world on that meeting. It's a great meeting. Pretty early for you folks, but you should look it up. It's on the Mid-Hudson OA website. But it says, we had to ask ourselves why we shouldn't apply to our human problems the same readiness to change our point of view. We were having trouble with personal relationships. I never felt close to anybody, maybe my family, but even my friends. I always kept you at arm length, right? We couldn't control our emotional natures. We were a prey to misery and depression. We couldn't make a living. We had a feeling of uselessness. We were full of fear. We were unhappy. That happens to me 3 days after I put down the food. This is how I begin to experience my day-to-day life without another solution. And I have an opinion about that other solution. My ego is in the way. I won't tap into this God. I won't fully commit. So fast forward to 2015, and I'm in Atlanta. I'm 11 years in the other fellowship. And I'm dying. I'm 420 pounds and I'm in bad shape. And I'm sitting on a bench resting, and a couple, a man and a woman who I had been acquaintances, I am acquaintances with, Polly, the man in the couple has since passed, rest in peace, but Ginny is still with us, and they approached me. They had heard me speak at a couple of retreats. See, you know, I run this thing under my nose pretty well, so I can get out amongst you and tell you, you know, I can tell you how to recover and not practice it. That's what was happening. And they knew me from that fellowship, and they came over and said, "How you doing?" And Ginny had this look on her face. She was looking me right in the eye. It was like she was looking through a clean glass window, man. I don't know. I just got a vibration off her that was powerful. And she looked at Polly and said, "Hey, go get us a cup of coffee." Now, we're at a convention that attracts 70,000 people to whatever city it's in. International AA convention is a beautiful thing. And if you're a 12-stepper, you should go sometime. It's just, if you want some juice, say the Serenity Prayer with 60,000 other people in a football stadium. That's juice. She looked at him and said, "Hey, go get us some coffee." And he said, "Are you crazy? The lines are a mile long." And she looked at him, and maybe some of the women on the meeting can identify with it. She gave him the wife voice. "Go get us some coffee." Right. "Oh, okay." And off he went. And she sat down. She sat down next to me and grabbed my hand. And she looked me in the eye and she said, "Patrick, how you doing?" And I said, "Fine," because, you know, I'm fine. I'm, you know, You're not going to get next to it. Because I can't do it without, I can't do life without it. I got to have something. And she squeezes my hand and she says, Patrick, I mean it. How are you doing? And in a lower voice, I said, fine. And she squeezed my hand one more time and she looked me in the eye and she said, Patrick, you're full of shit. You're dying. And as a recovered, responsible member of Overeaters Anonymous, I can't leave this convention without telling you what we have available in that fellowship. And she told me her story. Now, she's about 5 foot tall and she's always had a prosthetic leg on the left side. And, you know, that's not a question you ask somebody, hey, what happened to that piece of your leg? I had never, you know, I had never asked her. And she said, she told me her story and she had once been, you know, well over 250 pounds. And I mean, she's under 5 feet. She's like 4'10", just a little thing. And she was normally weighted. And I'd always seen her that way. And I'd always assumed she was a member of my other fellowship. But as a couple, he's a member of my other fellowship and she's a member of Overeaters Anonymous. And they'd go to 12-step conventions together. They would, you know, he would accompany her to OA conventions and she would accompany him to, obviously they're married, so they'd go together. And she proceeded.
Excuse me, you have 5 minutes left.
Thank you. She proceeded to 12-step me. And, you know, we talked for a long time and I thanked her and I got up and I walked away and I, you know, I flew home to Minneapolis and I ate like a madman for about 6 weeks, worse than ever. Because, you know, nobody puts baby in a corner, right? And I woke up one Sunday with a mustard seed of willingness and I got on the local website and it turns out there was a what turns out to be my live home group about a mile from my house in Minnesota. And I showed up on a Sunday night and I went to the meeting and after the meeting a man approached me and he asked me a very intrusive, annoying question. He said, hey man, what are you gonna have for breakfast? And I looked at him and I said, you know, for the first time in my life, I was honest. I said, I don't know. And he said, you know, I've got a food plan that worked for me. I'm about your size and I was about your size when I came in. Can I suggest what you might eat for breakfast? And then you call me in the morning and that's how it started. Thank God. Because the quality of my life today is so rich. It's so wonderful. It's so indescribably sacred what has happened in my life, the healing power. I've dropped over 220 pounds. My type 2 is in full remission. I kept my legs. I've lost 4 toes, 2 on each side. The first 2 toes on each side are gone, but small price to pay considering the condition I was in. And 2 weeks ago, I was in New Mexico and I hiked up to 8,550 feet in the mountains. The only reason I didn't go further was because there was snow and ice and it's a little too dicey. I looked at my buddy that I do that with, who's really kind of my spotter on these hikes. And he said, I don't think so. And I said, I agree. Right. I've resolved sleep apnea. I no longer have to take diabetic medication. My health has been restored by the grace and the higher power that I found by working the 12 steps of Overeaters Anonymous thoroughly in honesty and being accountable at a level that's uncomfortable. Transparent. I call my food in daily. I weigh and measure what I eat. And because it's a medical prescription for me and it needs to be that way. I'm not telling anybody else they have to do that. I'm telling you that that's what works for me. But it's not about that. It's about the spiritual path that I found in the 12 steps and my willingness to every day ask God for the power to remain abstinent, to do what I need to do each day, to read and write an assignment, to make 3 phone calls, to weigh and measure my food, to be accountable to a 10 step, and to reach out to newcomers wherever and whenever I can. And I do that. And I get to do a little bit of this in Overeaters Anonymous, go out and give talks and share my experience, strength, and hope. And what we have here is a sacred, redemptive, recuperating recovery program in the 12 steps that can allow you internal freedom that I didn't think existed. It's not just the physical change. It's the internal freedom to be who I am, where I am, with you, present, not distracted, but here. I say a prayer every time before I get on this. I say, God, make me fully present to those who need me to be fully present to them. Show me who I can help. And maybe I won't help anybody, but I'm pretty sure, just like the founder of Alcoholics Anonymous, Bill Wilson, who didn't find anybody to get sober for the first 6 months, but he stayed sober. So if none of you find anything useful in my talk, that's okay, because I've come here in a spirit of service that will allow me to maintain my abstinence. My hope, of course, is that somebody has found something in this talk that they can find useful. But I'm very, very grateful for the invitation here. And I'm very grateful every day for the members of Overeaters Anonymous that contribute. You know, just you being here on the screen is a contribution to my recovery. And I'm really grateful for that. So with that, I will pass. This is the time for questions only. There is no sharing at this meeting. If you need to share, please do so with any one of us after the meeting. Also, please remember that the opinions of the leader are my own and not those of Overeaters Anonymous as a whole. When asking questions, you need not identify yourself. If you asked a question last week, please wait till the first 3 questions have been asked before raising your hand. If you have a question, please click the raise your hand icon and I'll call on you. Okay, looks like Bob M, yeah. And then Marge.
Hey, thank you very much, Patrick. Incredible share. Do you have a daily ritual? And if you could describe it.
I do. So I get up very early in the morning and do, you know, my nature calls. And then I typically will hit my knees for a brief prayer, and then I get about my organizing my day, which includes preparing my food for the day. I prepare all my food that I take with me each work day, and that means weighing and measuring everything. Then I sit, typically I about a 20-minute meditation. And then I receive 2 calls at specific times from sponsees. And then I call my sponsor and I report everything that's going to go in my mouth that day. A thorough 10 step and a written assignment out of, usually right now I'm reading and writing out of the OA 12 and 12. Which I have found to be very refreshing. I haven't picked it up in a long time, other than just occasionally, like on a meeting or whatever, but I haven't really read through and written about it. So I've been finding that very good. I'm currently on step 10 and you know, that word continued, right? So I do that. So it takes usually my morning routine, you know, I'm up, I leave for work at 8:30 Central Time. So I'm usually up for about 2.5 hours. I don't spend all that time on OA stuff. I, you know, I'll do laundry. I'll do, you know, whatever. There's other things, but my routine comes first It is priority one. And then in the evening, I have a short routine as well, where I sit down and I answer all the questions that we find in the step 11 directions in the big book. And I write those out as well. And, you know, in between, I try to share the message with others as much as I possibly can in both my fellowships. When, you know, if you ask me, if you tell me I would be doing what I do on a daily basis today to maintain my spiritual fitness and my abstinence, I would have told you you're crazy, because I had an opinion about something I hadn't tried yet. But now it's second nature. It's routine. It's the way I live. It's ingrained. It's free. And I'm able to go do and accomplish things at an advanced age. I got my master's at 59 years old because of the freedom I found in Overeaters Anonymous to live well. So I hope that answers your question. Yes, I have a disciplined, committed routine. Marge.
Thank you. Hi, Patrick. Thank you so much for your share. You had said that your eating was not, it's not the food, but all the things that you couldn't deal with, life or the feelings. Mm-hmm. So how did you overcome that sense of living day to day with all the stuff that comes, you know, your way, aside from all the program stuff that you do, you know, like the feelings, I'm sure. And yeah, so just was wondering how you kind of segued into that.
Well, it was experiential, right? The first couple of years of my abstinence in Overeaters Anonymous was pretty raw. I'll just be honest with you. It wasn't easy. And my sponsor would remind me, where was it written that your life was supposed to be comfortable? You know, I've had people that were willing to ask me very difficult, uncomfortable questions because I have a life-threatening disease. And there's a known repeatable solution in the 12 steps in my investment in that. So how I deal with the feelings would be I would express them. And that's when I picked up the daily practice of inventory and began to see the root causes of how I would experience life day to day, a lot of it went away. The way I experience life day to day now is much more peaceful, free, and serene. That's not to say that Patrick doesn't still get that one thing offended. You know, I'm a guy that if you tell me to do something that's in my best interest, I got a little 4-year-old that lives in my head with no name. He's got a one word vocabulary and it's meow, right? I mean, Patrick, you might want to write some inventory about that. And the first thing that happens to me is meow. Right. That's the nature of my illness, is I'm very resistant to doing things that might be in my best interest. So it was experiential. The way I've heard this described with the feelings, Marge, is that the program is something that has to be repeated on a consistent basis. And it's like the effect of water on a sharp stone. Right. You know, you put a sharp stone in a stream, it's going to be sharp for a long time, but you come back 5 years later and those edges will be rounded off a little, right? Because of the effect that the water has had. We get immediate changes in recovery, but some of the changes take time. And I've also done a lot of outside work about the feelings that I have, because I had things happen to me as a kid that are outside issues at this meeting. But I had to deal with that. But I had to be abstinent first. So I've gotten a lot of help on how to process my feelings and how to live day to day. But if you follow the steps and do the work, the feelings change. How I experience challenges or difficulty in my life today is I respond to it as opposed to reacting to it. Michelle.
Hi, can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can.
Okay, great. Sorry. I can't turn my camera on. I'm having some issues over here, but thank you so much for your lead. And some of this was already touched on. I really got so much out of it, but I guess I figured I'd ask anyway. When you just actually like touched exactly on what I was going to ask, this in the moment, so I understand your daily practice, and in the moment, when that like page 52, that like state of being offended comes up, like a surprising conflict, or like if you have any tips about how to respond and not react. That was my exact question. And I feel like there probably isn't a shortcut. It's like you said, I mean, it takes years of time, but something happened the other day and I was just like, oh my God, I just totally reacted. I didn't respond. So I go back, I do my 10 step, but it's like, I want a shortcut because it just feels so awful when I know I just did the wrong thing.
Sure. Well, you're human, right? We're human beings. We're going to make mistakes, right? That's the purpose of the work, is so you can go clean it up. And, you know, it says, right, this thought brings us to step 10, which suggests we continue to take personal inventory and continue to set right any new mistakes as we go along. We vigorously commence this way of living as we cleaned up the past. We have entered the world of the spirit. Our function is to grow in understanding and effectiveness. We need experience, right? This is not an overnight matter. It should continue for our lifetime. Continue to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. When these crop up, it's not when, it's not if, it's when.
Yeah.
I mean, Michelle, welcome to the human race. You got surprised by something and you got pissed off. Mm-hmm. Okay. Go clean it up the next, you know, I'm not going to sit here and tell you that I walk through life like a monk. I work in the homeless services area, and I work with people with severe persistent mental illness, chronic addiction, homelessness, experiencing all the difficulties in a society, and I get confronted in ways that can be very challenging. I've been pulled into the principal's office a number of times for having bad reactions, right? Mm-hmm. But I'm much more likely to work through that, look at the root cause of it. And in the next situation that's similar, I tend to behave. And the thing that, one of the secret to my doing better with this was shutting my mouth.
Yep.
I have never had to make an amend for something I didn't say to somebody. Unless I was dishonest by omission, right? But it's rare now that if I'm experiencing that agitation or hijack, I say, you know, I need a minute or whatever. The book asks us to pause, right? Mm-hmm. It says we have ceased fighting anything or anyone. By this time, sanity will have returned, right? So if I follow these instructions on a daily, committed, disciplined basis, I have an experience with them that changes me without my permission. That's what happened to me. I got changed without my permission because I did consistent work with these disciplines. And these are disciplines. 10, 11, and 12 are strict spiritual disciplines. I had a mentor in AA that used to talk about them like that, and I didn't know what he said until I started to actually apply them to my life. Mm-hmm. And they are. Once you do that, you change without permission. So,
thank you.
You're welcome, Melissa. What time do we go to?
We have question and answers for the next 5 minutes. So
okay,
perfect time.
Thank you. Okay.
So here's my question. Can you share with us, by the way, thank you for your powerful share. It was fantastic. Can you share with us how your relationship with your higher power has maybe changed, grown, evolved over your time in program? Thanks.
That's a great question, Melissa. I really appreciate it because it's been an evolution, right? It's been a organic evolution of me. What I realized when I came from into this fellowship, while I'm still attending the other fellowship, is that I had compartmentalized my life in a bunch of different ways. I had put food in this room of the spiritual house over there, and you weren't going to come in there, You didn't get to come in there and disturb that one. There were other areas of my life. My financial life was a mess as well, right? Their relationships with my family were very, you know, at my convenience and not in a service-oriented way. What's happened as a result of OA and this process opening me up is my relationship with my higher power has continued to show me, okay, this is what's next. This is what's next. This is what's next. And I had a really, I wrote it down this morning. I heard something on the other meeting that was very, very powerful. And the speaker had said as a topic for shares, what are you holding back from God today? What area of your life are you not willing to let God into? Because it turns out I got to let him into everything. Because if I don't, the one thing I don't let him into, that'll kill me. So it's an evolution. I keep getting presented with new challenges in life. I keep, you know, I just accepted an executive position with a local nonprofit, a big one, over 500 employees. You know, the second day I was there, that imposter syndrome showed up, and I literally went into a men's room and hit my knees, and I said, "God, give me the strength to just get through today." And you know, we just had my 45-day review, and they are thrilled that I'm there, and I'm thrilled to be there. So it's just, you know, it keeps. The interesting thing is you turn your life and your will over to God, your whole life and your whole will over to God, strap in, because it's going to be a ride. It's going to be a good one, but it's a ride. You know, the amusement park had a few more options in it than I would have liked. Any other questions?
We have a minute and a half left.
A minute and a half or maybe one more. Okay, Rachel.
Hi, thanks for sharing. How, that was pretty amazing. How did your relationships with people change just from, it sounds like, yeah, just put the food down and yeah, it took time, but how did your relationships with people end up going from crap to what they are now, which I assume is better? Thanks.
They are. It's because I live a life of invitation, right? I invite the people that I want into my life, and I go where I'm invited, right? I'm present. When you have a spiritual practice, you live in the present. And when you are present to people, the nature of the relationships evolve more usefully. I bring a spirit of service into everything I do. I try to. I'm not perfect. Some days I show up selfishly. You know, I get up and I try to do better the next day. But when I bring a spirit of service to each relationship, when I look people in the eye and say, "Hey, you know, how you doing?" When I listen, right? When I don't give advice when it's not asked for, right? When I'm just with people, you know, that's how those relationships possible. So I hope that was helpful, Rachel.